Hey everyone, I am super excited because today we're kicking off season three of Taking Care of Business. I'm Mike Katz, EVP for the T-Mobile Business Group, and today I'm joined by Sri Shivananda for our very first episode of the season. Sri is the Chief Technology Officer at PayPal, and he is responsible for leading innovative products and services for people across the globe. He's also led global platforms and infrastructure at eBay for 13 years, and he currently sits on the board of directors for F5 Networks. Well, Sri, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show, Mike.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here. Next time, we're going to do it in person.
Absolutely. I look forward to that.
I wanted to dive right into a topic that I know is trendy, and I'm sure one that you have an opinion on, which is cryptocurrency. I wanted to get your thoughts on cryptocurrencies. What role are they playing today? What role do you expect them to play as we look forward in the future? And which one should I go buy?
I don't know if I'm going to give you advice on the last thing, but let me talk a little bit about digital currencies, blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and so on. It's now almost 12 years since the Bitcoin white paper came out and Bitcoin came into existence itself. But if you look at the underlying technologies behind Bitcoin, a lot of the research related to that happened much, much earlier. The earliest aspect of a blockchain as a technology was done in 1991. So Bitcoin was a bit of a confluence of technologies that people were playing with already to solve a specific problem with respect to distributed ledgers. And I think it has a critical role to play. The way I think of it is digitization of currencies is not only imminent, it's been happening for a while, and it's accelerated in the recent years. But most of what we see as customers or platforms is we've worked on the overlay for payments. A lot has changed with respect to experiences, how you interact, how you move and manage money, and so on. But the underlay for the payments infrastructure has not changed in decades. And while a transaction between you and me may feel like it's instantaneous, a lot happens in the background, and sometimes transaction takes weeks and months to even settle. What blockchain and the cryptocurrency space has to offer is a set of primitive technologies that we can take and start to reimagine that underlying infrastructure, that underlay that I talked about. And the reason that is important is so that we can actually increase the reach of digital payments well beyond the people who have access to it today and take it to the 1.8 billion people that are underserved by today's financial ecosystem. So once we start to reimagine the infrastructure and get to true digitization of payments in terms of the rails underneath, that will allow us to create a more ubiquitous way to involve more people in the ecosystem, be inclusive, and truly enable everyone equitably to move and manage money. There is amazing progress that's going on. We, of course, have introduced cryptocurrencies into the PayPal wallet. Last year, we launched the buy, sell, and hold capability in PayPal wallet. This year, we rolled it out to the Venmo wallet as well. And we have recently rolled out the ability to use cryptocurrencies as a funding instrument during checkout across more than 30 million merchants on PayPal. All this is more an attempt to learn along with the ecosystem, along with our customers, to help them come along with us. They learn with us, we learn with them. And we take the best of the ecosystem as we reimagine the financial infrastructure for the future. A lot to do here in terms of partnership with regulators, partnership with central banks, and so on. So it's done right as we think about the next 50 years of how payments are going to get done.
Yeah, speaking of that, between what you just described with blockchain and cryptocurrency, between a lot of the other innovation that you've driven at PayPal with peer-to-peer payments and everything else, when you think about the next 50 years, I know, which is a really long time horizon, are we gonna be in a world where paper money and coin money doesn't exist? Or if they do, what will their role be relative to digital currency?
Yeah, when I think about the future of payments by itself, digitization is happening already. most of us use less and less cash. My hope and prediction is that in a 10-year time frame, we'll not have a physical wallet anymore. And that's not just about money. It's about everything that goes into a physical wallet, probably including a driver's license and things of that nature. Either a mobile device that you carry or a wearable that you have on you would be sufficient for you to both identify yourself and pay for anything that you want as a product or a service as well. And that's not even 50 years out. When I think about experiences itself, they're beginning to evolve. At the same time, I'm a strong believer of the fact that the future is already here. It's just not equitably distributed. And let me give you some samples of that. Contextual commerce through the devices around you is continuing to grow. Also, at the same time, I believe that payments has always been that last thing that you do in any commerce interaction. That is somewhat of a friction. It's a chore that you need to complete. And we are now beginning to see experiences. I'll give you an example of one that you might have experienced as well, or anyone in our audience has. When you take a ride share today with an Uber or a Lyft, when do you pay? Ask yourself that question. And what you'll quickly realize is you don't. You express the intent for a ride. You take a ride. When you finish the ride, the payment happens automatically. That is what ambient payments is all about. And we'll see more and more of that. We feel this in experiences like the one I described, or for that matter, in the tons of subscriptions that all of us have where the payment is automated, or even more traditionally, bill pay, where you pay for all your utilities, but you're not going through an explicit act of payment. So in many ways, payments has the potential of disappearing as something that you do, but still be there so that there's value exchange that occurs between consumers, merchants, and other part of the ecosystem. Last thing I'll say on this is there's a lot that is going to happen in terms of payments initiated by devices. Happens already. When I rent a movie today on Apple TV or Prime for that matter, the payment happens in the background based on store credentials that you have. Again, express the intent to watch a movie, the payment occurred automatically. So these experiences are going to surface more and more. It's going to become the new normal of the payment UX, if you will. And definitely in this process, cash becomes even less relevant. On top of all of this, cash is a physical thing that has exchanged a lot of hands, probably is the biggest carrier of the thing that we've feared most for the last year. And that'll be another reason cash will continue to reduce significantly. In a 50-year timeframe, I absolutely hope that we are done with cash and every payment interaction we have is fully digitized.
It's so fascinating. And your example really made me think, it's like, yeah, we actually are fairly far through this journey. I was thinking also about, you know, the way I interact with brands like Starbucks, where I, you know, my wallet never gets pulled out. It's all a swipe of my phone, and for the most part virtualized. When you think about the further progression of this fully digitalized commerce world, you know, this is kind of a two-part question. Like, one, what are going to be some of the big things that have to be true to enable this to continue to scale the way it's been scaling? And then, what are some of the big risks? What are some of the things that either are known risks today or potential unintended consequences of us moving to a world where payments are much more digitized?
Yeah, let me first talk about the first part that you asked about, which is what are the enablers? I think the continuous adoption of mobile, which is already an ubiquitous form of interaction, not just for commerce, but socially and everything else in terms of entertainment, information consumption, and so on, that trend is a critical foundation. The second aspect of this is connectivity. Connectivity in terms of when we moved from earlier generations of connectivity to more newer generations of connectivity, for example, let's take the most prevalent one, which is 4G. There were a lot of new kinds of businesses that came into existence, a lot of new kinds of interactions that came into existence. And there is a lot more that's happening with the move to 5G as well. So mobile adoption, connectivity, these are two foundational aspects. Third is the continued acceleration of convenient and secure experiences for both consumers on the one hand and merchants on the other hand. I would say fourth is that aspect that I mentioned about the continuing reimagining and re-architecture of the underlying payment infrastructure that will make it faster, safer, and cheaper to do payments. All of this together will help us create what we need to create for today, tomorrow, and 10 years from now. And those are critical. All of this, of course, is centered in a customer-centric mindset. It is important to understand what our customers need, both said and unsaid, take that into a process internally and build amazing and delightful products and experiences that our customers both desire and deserve. Now, let's talk about some of the challenges. We have to make sure, given all of us are in the business of trust, that cybersecurity is something we get absolutely right. The safety and security of our consumers and their transaction is probably the most important thing we need to deliver. Second, we need to be respectful of our customers and offer them the highest privacy experience that they desire. Some cases, they may not even be aware of what they need for privacy, and we need to be able to deliver that for them, educate them, and help them understand what those things mean. Of course, being a global business also means that we have to collaborate with regulators around the world to be compliant in every one of the hundreds of jurisdictions that we operate in. And last but not least, a lot of us are beginning to use a lot of ML and AI. And while those are amazing technologies to use in personalization, in customer service, and fraud prevention, and so much more, I think we all have to be careful and pay a lot of attention to the ethical aspects of ML and AI and have controls and abilities to ensure that we create an absolutely unbiased platform that is inclusive of everyone in the world.
So Sri, I want to go back to something that you said earlier about blockchain specifically and just kind of get your thoughts and perspective on blockchain as a technology. You know, certainly you kind of described its importance in the cryptocurrency space. Are there other applications that you are seeing or forecasting for blockchain?
Absolutely. I think what our blockchain research group has been doing is discovering the breadth of use case that something like a distributed ledger with the level of security and immutability that it provides and all that it can do. One of the use cases that we are pretty excited about is the identity use case and being able to create sovereign identity, which is still not necessarily a solved problem on the internet. We also think that there is a big play for blockchain in the area of contracts, in the area, for that matter, of supply chain and various other use cases. I think anywhere you want a permanent record with a level of specificity and accuracy that can be tracked back and cannot be tampered with is a use case for blockchain. It's still early days from a blockchain perspective. There are public blockchains like the one that Bitcoin supports and Ethereum supports and so on. We are also excited about the aspect of enterprise or private blockchains as well. I think particularly in the payments industry, being able to do instant settlements is an aspect that we are excited about. Today, it takes many days to actually settle forward. There are other use cases in which a blockchain can be applicable as well, but that's a part of ongoing R&D. What we need to figure out is how do you scale it to the level of transaction throughput that is expected from businesses like ours over a period of time. There again, we've seen the first generation evolve into second generation evolve into third generation of blockchains that's beginning to create a layered approach that can create the throughput that we desire in the transaction space. Today, the Bitcoin blockchain only does less than 10 transactions a second. And to be able to get to the volume that most payments companies do, you had to get to a minimum of 1,000, potentially 10,000 transactions per second to be able to use it in a viable way.
One of the things that you also mentioned earlier was the progress that's been made in digital transactions in this last mobile era of 4G. As you look ahead, obviously, we're in obviously the early days of 5G, but as you look ahead to a 5G that's more ubiquitous across the world, what are some of the things that you think are going to define or accelerate what's happening in digital payments because of the capabilities of large-scaled 5G networks?
I've seen each generation of connectivity create new opportunities and new contexts, and it fosters level of innovation in connecting people across the globe. Where I think 5G's potential is one, in the ability to deliver a much richer and more immersive commerce experience to the customers on their device with additional layers of user experience enrichment coming from the concept of extended reality paradigms and so on. And this will continue to create a step function acceleration in digital commerce. There are still certain things that people say, you know what, I want to go touch it or see it. And what 5G has the capability to do is to take some of those situations away and bring them online and bring them into the virtual world. That's one. Second is contextual commerce itself, as I mentioned before, through devices around us will become more commonplace. And 5G allows for a faster fabric to connect those devices to create good services of value. This will allow a continued shift of the paradigm from customer goes to the shop to shop comes to the customer. And finally, 5G has the potential for larger amounts of data and, for that matter, machine learning models to travel faster to the device of interaction that can allow for more real-time protections, personalization, and perks wherever they are. So 5G will absolutely enhance our digital lives. And in the process, every context where payment is relevant is a place that PayPal will play a role.
Obviously, as the CTO of PayPal, as you're thinking about your strategy and as you're making technology decisions for the company and for the company's strategy, how much is 5G factoring into those decisions right now? And what specifically do you think these the early days of 5G, the next year or two, what kinds of capabilities do you expect, both for your own operations, but also for the applications you're supporting for customers? Which ones do you expect to be impacted by 5G the most?
Yeah, so you know, when we think of our technology strategies, we definitely think of the areas that we need to explore and the areas we need to exploit. And 5G happens to be one of those places where we are going to exploit the 5G revolution that's already occurring with great players like you building out the network and the underlying rails for faster connectivity. Once that faster connectivity starts to emerge, just like we saw with previous generations of connectivity improvement, we will see certain new kind of experiences and new business models emerge. And we'll be there, right there, with the right kind of platform approaches, the right kind of APIs and right kind of SDKs to immerse the payment capability into those experiences and therefore be a part of that richer experience consumers will see in commerce.
One of the things I think this last year really shined a large spotlight on was that there is a digital divide, and it's unfortunately alive and well and significant in the US. And as you think about these new technologies like 5G, technologies like that accelerating adoption and capability of digital commerce and potentially replacing even some traditional commerce in areas, what do you think the risks are of the digital divide and its potential to like really leave people behind in this new area? And what can companies and business leaders do about it?
The digital divide, like you said, is absolutely real. And oftentimes, us as companies in the Bay Area, we think ahead, and many times we think a decade ahead of where most of the part of the world may be. Now, there are more pockets of innovation that are beginning to come up, and there are epicenters that are getting created, but there's a bubble around those epicenters around the world as to what the reach of those technologies are. That said, technology is commoditizing. The ownership of mobile devices and smart mobile phones is increasing significantly year over year. And it's beginning to reach all parts of the globe in a way that it's going to become ubiquitous. Devices are becoming cheaper, services are becoming cheaper too. And that'll allow the inclusion of that underserved population that I mentioned, not just in the area of commerce and payments, but also in the area of education, staying informed, participating in the system, and being included more holistically than commerce alone. It'll take decades for us to all achieve that. And this is a place where all industries can actually participate together to continue to reduce that divide, remove that barrier to entry that exists for those that are underserved, and make it equitable for basic aspects to be something that everyone can count on around the world. We shouldn't be only counting on the governments in every jurisdiction to take these actions, but we should participate as corporations in eliminating the digital divide or accelerating the reduction of the digital divide as quickly as we can.
Speaking of around the world, because PayPal obviously is a global company, what are some of the things that you're seeing in other parts of the world that maybe we haven't seen in the US or that are inspiring things that are driving your US strategy?
Like I mentioned before, there used to be a time where the western part of the United States was the epicenter for most innovation in these areas. But what has happened over the last decade very clearly is more and more of those epicenters have sprung up, many in Asia, many in Europe, and many in various other continents too. What we see is an amazing amount of innovation that's happening in parallel in all of these areas around the world. We've seen in Asia the fastest growth in digitization occur over the last decade. And there are many experiences that we see in Asia today that are not yet available in the United States. What's great though is the best innovation comes from two or three different ideas coming together. And now there is a larger diversity of those that are emerging around the world. And when those ideas come together over a period of time, all of those will normalize. Like I mentioned before, the future is already here. It's just not equitably distributed. And the best of ideas across the industry coming together and us normalizing that by eliminating that digital divide that I mentioned is where the opportunity is to ensure that we can truly create an equitable commerce and payment system. I'll give you a quick example. We were talking about our customers for the Zoom service we have. This, by the way, is XOOM. And that is a remittance service we have as a part of the company. There are certain immigrant workers who have to take half a day off, travel to one store in the corner of a town to send money back to their family. Just think about the potential of digitization there, where they don't have to take the time off. They can actually do it on a fairly cheap mobile device, securely and safely. The money actually reaches their family fairly instantaneously. And the cost of that money movement is much, much cheaper. It's those kinds of paradigms and experiences that I get very excited about.
How much of that do you see as already happening in a more advanced way than maybe it is in the US? Because it feels like one of the things that I've heard before is particularly in countries that are underdeveloped in their banking infrastructure, that some of these technologies have had to evolve at a more rapid pace. Is that true? And is there something that can be learned here by virtue of that?
Yeah, history repeats itself on these kinds of things. And I think what happens is in many cases, nations and geographies that may be starting late on a technology have the benefit of working on completely new paradigms. When I was growing up, having a landline at home was a luxury. And it was not something that was common across every home. At the same time, when 3G first came out in India, it took off very, very quickly. One, there was no tethering to the older infrastructure that existed. And this new technology just offered an acceleration that was bound to happen because there was so much value to be created. And I think that's happening in the payments industry too, where traditional infrastructures don't exist. more modern infrastructures are the first time it actually becomes possible. And you see that acceleration occur there. I would say that there are experiences that exist in other parts of the world that may not exist in the US today, but it's quickly following up and it's beginning to happen. Whether it's the ubiquitous use of your mobile device for every transaction, every interaction, every transit, and everything in terms of your digital life, I think that is still to actually accelerate in the US, but the paradigms are beginning to get shared, and those shared paradigms are beginning to accelerate the world as a whole. No matter where the idea starts, it spreads quickly.
I wanted to shift a little bit and ask a question about you, specifically about you as a leader of a big global company. And I've seen you talk about your leadership philosophy and specifically what you call the four phases of leadership. And I was hoping that you could share that with us and talk a little bit more about what it is, what it's meant to you as a leader and how you live it every day.
Yeah, the four phases of leadership is a bit of what I've studied over time and a bit of actual experiences that I've been through myself. I never imagined being an organizational leader. I wanted to be an individual contributor and be a technology fellow at the company. But the moment I started to have a team and work with a team, I started to realize the multiplicative potential of what that meant. And within a year, I was not only hooked, I was loving it. And I wanted to learn more and more about what leadership was. The first phase of leadership that I went through was a phase of effectiveness. And this was all about my skill, my ability to execute, my ability to manage people, and things of that nature. It's about making sure that the outcomes that are desired from me and my team are something that I'm able to deliver to fairly quickly. As I started to grow in my career, I got more and more responsibility. Suddenly, my team grew. I went from being a first level manager to a second level manager. And I found myself in the phase of scale. And in scaling, what you did in effectiveness is essential, but it's not sufficient. You start to learn about what change management is all about, what crisis management is all about, what conflict management is all about. You first, for the first time, get exposed to what financial discipline is all about, how you need to be a broader leader than just in your own domain, how you need to build relationships, how you need to influence the rest of the organization, and so on. And just like you scale technology, you had to scale yourself as a leader, and there are many techniques you need to learn to do that. As you scale, at some point in time, you scale to a point where the imposter syndrome catches up with you. And you start to ask yourself, fine, you've done everything mechanically to prepare for a large organization that you're managing and leading, but are you truly ready on the inside? The journey turns inward. And when the journey turns inward, you start to grow internally in terms of basic aspects of mindfulness, like you stop judging people. You start thinking in terms of agenda. You start thinking in terms of win-win. This is a phase where it's not about what you do, but about what you become. And it's also the phase in which you actually build resilience as a leader, resilience as a person. You actually become a better person by yourself. And I call that the phase of resilience. And if you pass these three phases, by the way, all of them are cumulative, of course, you get to a phase of being a transformational leader, one that has the ability to mobilize, inspire, and actually create followership that exists long after you're done with the role. And these are basically what I consider the four phases of leadership. As I mentioned, a lot of it is what I've experienced over time, and some of it is what I've read as I've grown as well.
Yeah, those are so great. They're powerful and they're true. And your comment about them being cumulative just feels so spot on to me. And they're not mutually exclusive either, because when you were describing the third one, one thing that I've often talked about is one of the most important leadership traits that I see, which is almost exactly what you described, is great self-awareness and being able to understand, be comfortable, and show some vulnerability of the things that you're both good and maybe not so good at, and a willingness to learn. And without that, it's really difficult, especially when you get in these kinds of jobs, to be able to effectively build teams around you. Because if you don't have that great self-awareness and you don't know and aren't comfortable with the things that you're not really strong at, it's really difficult for you to identify and have confidence to bring people in that are way better than you at other things that you're not as good at. It's a great framework that young leaders should really be studying and thinking about. So thanks for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I got some rapid fire questions for you. Really important, maybe arguably the most important question so far of this interview. Favorite dessert?
You know, Mike, I do not discriminate. Any dessert is welcome. It's a weakness in some ways, but if you were to put a spread of sweets in front of me, I would pick syrupy Indian sweets as the first thing I'd go after. And I promise you, I'll still eat the rest of the stuff.
I love this next one because, like I was telling you before we started, you have a little a clue in the background, but it also will prove how big of nerds you and I both are. Two-part question. Favorite Star Wars movie, and then favorite character of movie.
And I'll surprise you with this. Yes, I have a Star Wars helmet here, but I'm actually a bigger Star Trek fan than a Star Wars fan. That said, I'll stay with the spirit of the question. I like anything sci-fi. I eat up these movies. I love the whole series. My favorite character on the Star Wars side is Yoda, of course. On the Star Trek side, again, love the whole saga, but my favorite character there is Spock.
That was maybe even a more nerdy answer than I was expecting. So that was perfect. If you had given it in Klingon, it would have been even better. If you're about to go do a big speaking engagement, or if you're just in a situation that you need to be pumped up and excited and high energy, what's your walkout music?
I have two choices. One would be Enterprising Young Men, which is a Star Trek theme song. And the second one is Rise from Dark Knight Rises, where Batman escapes from the pit.
Yeah.
So those are two of my favorite music preludes.
Really important one. Pineapple on pizza. What say you?
Don't love it, but you know, I don't mind it.
So you're agnostic.
Yeah.
Kind of similar food-based one. Cake or pie?
Pie. Always pie.
I could not agree more. Last but not least, dream dinner guest.
Dream dinner guest. It's a dream. So if I can include dead people, that would be Nikola Tesla. If it was somebody that's alive, of course, it would be an Indian mystic and yogi. His name is Sadhguru.
Well, Sri, thank you so much. This was wonderful. It was such a great opportunity to get a chance to talk with an incredible leader like you that's doing unbelievable things and working on things that I think we're going to look back on in the next decade and point to how literally our lives have changed. I don't want to be over dramatic, but the stuff that you're working on literally changes the way that we interact with each other on a daily basis. And I think all the things that you said make me believe that over this next decade, we are going to see a step change in how our behaviors together, our behaviors with merchants work. So thank you for your leadership there. Thank you for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, Mike, thank you for having me on the show. And look, we have a mission of wanting to democratize financial services, and a partnership with a company like yours on that aspect of connectivity that I mentioned, that is essential. That's what brings people together. And those are places that we can collaborate a lot.
I totally agree. And you know, especially in the areas that we talked about earlier on how we ensure that everybody has access to these technologies so that nobody's left behind.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. For those tuning in, thank you so much for listening. And a reminder that each episode this season of Taking Care of Business, we are excited to expand our Project 10 Million donation to a school district that each of our guests choose, which we think is going to help us make further progress towards bridging the schoolwork gap and ensuring that every child in America has equal access to reliable, high-speed connectivity for all of their remote learning and all of their homework. We will see you next time for another episode of Taking Care of Business. Bye-bye.